Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the great pleasure of interviewing a woman I've known for quite a long time. Her name is Gwen Dawson, and sadly she's had an unfortunate lot of experience with dementia, both in her mother, and your mom died from dementia, I think, right? And now your husband. And I've known you so long, and I've seen you go through the struggles how this has affected you. And I invited you onto the show because I think you have lots of really important information about the subject of dementia and dealing with it and the emotional toll that it takes and so on and so forth.
Dr. Dana Saperstein in the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
So, Gwen, welcome. I really appreciate you coming on the Fear Me Out podcast.
Thanks, Dana. I'm glad to be here, I think.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes, right?
Really? Yeah. I don't know. It's not exactly comfortable.
No, and it's also a painful subject. I know
that's
that.
That's why it's not comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, if it's okay with you, would you mind starting off talking a bit about your mom and what it was like to, you know, to watch your mom begin that process?
Yeah, I will start with my mom, whose name was Mary Taylor, and she had Alzheimer's. She had the diagnosis of Alzheimer's for 8 years.
Wow, and, that's a long time.
Seemed to go on forever. And my dad was alive, Stuart Taylor, and he was trying to take care of her, but he didn't understand the disease. And he didn't read any books about it. He was an old man. Right. And he was a traditional old man, you know, the way fathers were in the 50s or whatever. So he, you know, he was used to being in charge. He didn't know what to do about mom. So I was teaching full-time. I'm an elementary school teacher. And that was so hard to split my attention sort of between mom and what the heck's going on there and then teaching. And that's why I came to you a lot and talked to you about all these things. Anyway, my mother had been a very lively, funny, wonderful woman, I thought. And she was a stay-at-home mom. But she did want to be a landscape architect, she told Dad. And she thought she'd go to school when the kids were grown. He gets, oh, no, I need you here. Stuff like that just really makes me mad.
Yeah.
So she was very sweet. But what got to Dad is she ran away one time. Well, probably maybe more than one. But he was listening to golf in the den. And she was somewhere in the house, like in the kitchen. So I'm trying to picture what happened with her. She's hearing men's voices, you know, golf and announcers and whatever the sound of the TV is. And I personally think she was scared of men. Because she did is she ran out the back door. And they lived near the Y and Montecito. She crawled under the gate to their community.
Wow.
I don't know how that happened. She was always very physical, but I didn't know she could crawl under a gate. And she ran up East Valley Road.
Wow.
No, up San Ysidro Road and then East Valley.
And how old was she at this time?
This was early onset. It started, she was 64 when it started.
Oh.
And by the time she was running away, it was maybe 4 years later or something. So anyway, she ran away. So I was at school. I think Dad called Roger, my husband Roger. And he went to look for Mom. And he found her at the upper Montecito Village. There's some linen shop there.
Right.
A hairdresser thing. She was there.
Wow.
And she was shaking and crying. And when she saw Roger, she said, oh, Roger. And he just embraced her, and she went to him. But the sad thing is my dad came with his friend Dotsie, who was looking for Mom, and she was scared of Dad.
Oh.
So that broke his heart. So she wouldn't go to him. She went to Roger.
Huh.
And he didn't have the capacity to understand that. He was very black, white, literal. So
certainly a man of his generation.
Exactly. So Dotsie and Dad thought they couldn't go to his house because Mom was scared. So they went off to Dotsie's house, and Roger went and calmed Mom down. But I think that something broke in my father, I think, there. Mm-hmm. And it broke in all of us. But I was
How old were you at the time? I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's a good question. I think I was still in my 40s. Hard to believe.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe late. Yeah, mid. Actually, not even that late in my 40s. And so I didn't know all that much about, you know, my mother was sort of the first person I knew to go through these old age things.
Right.
And I was the first person I knew to be a daughter in an old age
thing. Yeah, yeah.
So I had a lot of learning to do. And I went to I remember going to an Alzheimer's Association meeting. Because people would say, oh, you know, you should do one of those. Well, a woman there was talking about how she, you know, she almost wished she could kill her mother.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't do that. I can't sit here. This is, that woman's experience was farther down the line than my experience. And I thought,
right.
This is not helping me.
Okay.
So then I'd just come to you, basically, and talk to my friends and my sister, Claire.
Right. I don't recall me telling you that you should kill your mom.
No, I don't think it was you. No, other people, not you.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't make light. That's not nice.
No, that's okay. You know, people still tell me that. I think, been there, done that.
Right, right.
So anyway, Mom, then she was at a, Dad put her in a facility up here. Because she wouldn't get in bed with him one night, or she wouldn't let him get in bed. Again, he had no capacity. I would have just said, okay, and go in the guest room.
Right.
Dad didn't act like that. Right. So she said she would kill him herself if he came near her.
Wow.
So he called me and said, we've reached the end of the road. So I'm supposed to go pick her up, take her to my house. And he'd chosen a facility that I didn't like. On the Mesa, and so I was in charge of taking her there the next day.
Wow!
And then they said, "Don't come see her for 2 weeks." And I said, "Are you kidding me?"
Wow!
Well, now I've talked to other people, and they say the transition's really hard, and they, you know, try to make it easier. But I don't think that people at that facility were really doing anything in those two weeks.
Yeah.
So I actually put on a big hat disguise and went in. Just to look at her during the 2 weeks. But I just thought, something's not right. And my sister Claire, who knows a lot more than I do about all these things, she called the ombudsman and said, what is going on here about 2 weeks? And the next thing we know, that the doctor's calling us, me, at school, and saying, what are you doing? You know, they're tearing the place up. And I thought, it's a right to call an ombudsman. It doesn't mean they should tear anything up, but maybe they had something to hide at that place.
Right, right.
Because it was a very, and then, of course, Dad was furious at us. Well, I didn't even do it, but he was mad at me. So that was all traumatic. But to make a long story short, we also tried a caregiver, you know, company 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that went okay for a while. And then the caregiver moved Mom into another bedroom. Because I guess Dad wasn't sleeping well, but he didn't like that, but she did. So then she went back in this place I didn't like, and they called me at school, the doctor did, and said, your mom has septicemia. And they would like her out of there.
Wow.
I said, what? They don't like their count, their dead count or something? So I said, bring her to my house. So he said, get a hospital bed, call. I think he called, they'll bring her to your house. So Roger was at home waiting for the hospital bed because I was still at school. So the paramedics brought Mom up to my house. And I thought someone would just drive her in a car. I didn't realize we were ambulance if someone is dying.
Oh.
And they had oxygen. And I thought, if she's dying, why are you all doing all this? And so they got her out in a gurney outside. And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. And they said, it's a beautiful thing what you're doing. I said, do you have advice for me? And they said, unplug all the phones. This was before cell phones were
important.
I said, why would I do that? He said, don't call 911. And I said, I am not calling 911.
Oh, okay.
Let me guarantee you of one thing. I will not do that.
Right.
But they thought I'd get traumatized and want help because they'd have to save her if I called.
Right, right.
So she was there on a Tuesday. She died on a Friday. My sister got there.
That was quick.
It was, thank God. No food or water because she was what hospice calls non-responsive.
Oh, okay.
My sister got there from the Bay Area. And we turned her and put pillows all around her, and we'd sit and talk to her, and Dad would come over and cry and say, my precious darling, and we'd go, oh, geez, how long is this going to go on?
Oh.
So then her doctor made a house call, which was sweet, and just said, this is a really wonderful thing you're doing. And I had to get Roger's permission to have my mother die at the house because he had built the house. You remember the big deal with the house?
Oh, right, yeah.
He built our, it wasn't my house then. And so he had this great love of his house. And I thought, having someone die at your house is probably a new experience for a lot of
yes,
people.
I would imagine.
So I had to get him to agree, which was really nice of him. And then we had an upstairs, and Mom was in the living room. And so Roger would come downstairs early to grade papers, but he wanted me to go first, which I understand. He didn't want to find his,
he didn't want to find his, right.
And then then my brother got there, Stuart, from the East Coast, and my son, Jay, came. And so we were sort of doing our goodbyes. We had the caregiver that we'd had before. We went out to lunch and to have a little break, and we got a phone call that she had died.
Well, you guys went to lunch.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought that was okay because when I thought about it, my mother was really a private person in many ways. And I thought, how could she die with us sitting around, going, oh, Mom, what's happening? So then we have dead Mom in the living room. And we sort of stayed with her for a little while, but I didn't know about bathing the body then, which I've since learned, which I would have done had I known. So we just kind of put flowers on the bed and cried and held her and stuff. And then when I called the mortuary people, they came and they were outside and, with their big zip bag they had. And Dad said, I remember this from my father. I'm not going to stay in this room.
Wow.
So he went to the kitchen. And the mortuary people, I said to them, I said, she really doesn't weigh very much. Do you think you could pick her up and take her outside to your gurney? I just didn't want all this death industry in my house. So they did. They were really very kind.
Oh,
and we also had a brain autopsy.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because I'd gone to Alzheimer's educational meetings, and we had three children of Mom, and now we have five grandchildren, I guess. We thought, well, we'd like to know if Alzheimer's is in our gene pool. And it is.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not ever going to be tested ahead, that some people
will
be tested.
Right.
I don't want to know.
Yes.
Let it be a surprise.
Well, and you've outlived your mom already anyways,
and
right?
I what?
You've outlived your mom.
Yeah, I have. Oh, way out. You're right. She died at 71 or something. I mean, it wasn't really her anymore, but it looked like her.
Yeah.
Which is another confusing thing about Alzheimer's and dementia. The person's physical appearance hasn't usually changed much in their voice. And so it's sort of like you're with this replica of the person, but the person's not there.
And how'd your dad deal with losing his wife?
He was heartbroken. And I told him that I wanted to talk at the funeral memorial thing. And he said, well, I don't know why you would want to talk. Something, it bothered him that I wanted to talk. And he said, well, you just kind of went in and grabbed that. And I said, I'm not grabbing anything. I would like to speak at Mom's memorial. I think he thought my brother Stuart would be the one to speak and not me.
Okay.
But we both spoke. And it was important to me to kind of say something rather than have the minister be in charge. So I don't know. Dad's life was really hard after that in many ways. I went to the house a week or two after Mom died, and he was inside crying.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, did something happen? He had a paper in his hand. And he said, well, the Valley Club just sent the bill for her golf locker.
Oh, right.
So I said, I'll call the Valley Club and I'll tell them she died.
Right.
You don't have to do that. I'll do it. But just all those little things, you know, where people don't know if the person has died in some ways. And I remember when he died, he had a dentist appointment the next day.
Oh.
So I called the dentist's office and said I left a message. Sorry, my father died. He's not coming in today.
Yeah.
And just crazy.
How long did your dad live after your mom died?
I'd say maybe 10 years.
Oh, so he had a full decade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he
went to Casa Durinda. He needed to get out of the house.
Oh,
the house
okay.
He couldn't really drive. He had macular degeneration. The house was huge. He was on the list at Casa, which is not my favorite place. And Roger took him over there and got all him signed up. So he lived in a small little studio.
Wow.
It was a very humble place. He was not materialistic.
No.
And then he did have friends there. So he left the cocktail hour.
Yeah. Well, so he did sort of go on with his life after.
Yeah, he tried to. And I know there was one woman after a few years, he sort of liked. And, I would see her a couple times at dinner. And Dad was really Republican, and I couldn't talk politics with him.
No, I guess
it was
not.
Awful. And she said, this woman, whose name I've forgotten, was a Democrat. And she said, and Dad held forth on something that I couldn't stand. And she said, Gwenny, it's getting worse.
Oh.
I mean, Dad was more and more conservative. And I thought, Dad, if you're trying to impress her, this is not working.
It's not working. Right. Oh, that's awful.
So then he died.
Yeah. So when I first met you, your relationship with your husband, Roger, was so sweet. It was so lovely. And I don't know if you remember, but I remember saying to you many times, you know, you guys are my heroes. You've been, the way that you loved each other and the way that you lived your life was so sweet and just really lovely. I mean, the love was so tangible and so easy to, you know, to see and feel. You guys, it just seemed like you guys were really made for each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know how much you travel, and it just was amazing for a really long time.
Yeah, so I can see myself as lucky.
Yes.
In that context.
So when did you first start noticing a change in him?
He was 76. I do remember that.
And how old is he now?
He's 85 almost in a month.
Oh, so
it's been
9 years ago.
9 years. I used to think it was seven, but I forgot to add the most recent year.
Oh, yeah.
It just goes on and on and on.
So what did you first notice?
Let me think. Well, his checkbook, stuff like he couldn't do some of the things he used to be able to do. The remote for the television and the music, he had lost contact with that. His checkbook began to be, inaccurate. His, what else did he, it's hard to remember way back to those days. He couldn't remember names. He was never good at them, but he couldn't remember. He just seemed really starting to be confused.
Okay.
And would see somebody he would know in the past and he wouldn't know them.
Oh, okay.
Or he'd say, who was that? Or how do I know them? And then I remember he's also hard of hearing, which doesn't help.
No.
So I remember talking to his daughter, Michelle, and I said, I think something's going on with his memory. And she said, yeah, well, it could be his hearing.
Oh.
But it's not his hearing. I just knew it was not his.
Okay.
But, you know, that's an interesting thing for people who have someone with dementia, with a hearing loss. It makes everything worse. It makes everything harder.
It's more confusing to figure out what the problem is.
Yeah, right.
And did any of this bring back sort of old trauma from losing your mom?
Yeah, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm sure I'm still in it, right? Dana, you're the expert.
Well, I know the way situation is now that it's really, really difficult. That,
yeah, right.
You know, he's progressed to a point where he's very, very, I mean, it's amazing how well he does considering how impaired that he is.
I know, because Dana and I see each other on the, what's it called, the breakwater.
On the break, yes.
We're taking walks.
At the harbor all the time,
right.
Yes.
And so nowadays, we used to walk out to the end where you all are and look at the view. Nowadays, we take a shorter walk and sit on a bench for a while, and we get up and see if we can get to the next bench. Because physically, his ability to walk and be in balance has really gone.
Is that a function of the Alzheimer's, of the dementia?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. And I had him walk for his neurologist a couple of years ago, and he said, yeah, he's got a wide gait. I mean, he noticed it was an odd walk. So that's another thing, is his physical loss, and he was a very good athlete and bicyclist, and that was super important to him.
Yeah, he rode his bike forever.
Oh, and he rode it to school. He rode everywhere. He rode up Gibraltar, and sometimes now he'll say, well, I just need to get out on my bike. And I think, no, you don't need to get out on your bike, because he could break a hip, you know, his balance. Right. But he doesn't have any self-awareness of that. So what I did is, he has five bikes. So I got some locks, and they're hanging in the garage, and I tried to lock two of them together that he wouldn't, and then I hid the key, so that he wouldn't, if he ever thought he was going to ride a bike, he wouldn't be able to go out there and hop on it.
Right.
It makes me sad, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
When I hear him say, I'm going to ride my bike, or let's go on a trip, you know, we haven't been to Italy, and I think, I am never going to Italy with you again in my life. I cannot manage him. I'm going to San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's another loss, too. The travel, the loss of the life you had with the person.
Right.
Everything shrinks.
Right. So how are you managing emotionally?
I'm a mess, I think. But I have great support.
Okay.
And I come to you if I'm really out, you know, thinking, I just don't know what to do. I'm on antidepressants, which I have been for years because of the anxiety and panic disorder I had years and years ago before Roger's problem.
Okay.
So I think that probably helps.
And what does your support look like? Just give people an idea.
Okay, well, the antidepressants are helpful. I'm in a caregiver support group that I've been in for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And there are usually maybe five or six of us there. Once in a while, it's more. And we just got a brand new person this week who I knew already. And she has earlier experiences that I had. You know, she's beginning to notice these changes. And then what is I really like about a support group, and also people who, I'm a hospice volunteer, people who've gone through the hospice training, they know you can't fix this. A lot of people just want to fix it. And they'll say, well, have you tried?
Really?
All the time.
People give you advice about what to do about dementia all the time?
Have you tried looking at facilities? Have you tried some new drugs? Have you been to the doctor? Have you done this? And I feel like hitting them. I feel like punching them. I think, what do you think I am, an idiot?
Yeah.
But people who've been trained by hospice, in my experience, and people in my group, do not do that. We do not try to fix each other. Because this cannot be fixed.
Okay.
And in our society, that doesn't go over well.
No.
Especially men want to fix things. You know, they want to take action. Wouldn't that be fun, you know, to give up all this suffering and take some action and do something? There's nothing to do that would help.
You know, I really believe that when somebody gives an unsolicited advice like that it's not for you.
Oh.
It's for them.
Because they're uncomfortable, probably.
Yes. They don't know what to do or what to say.
You're right.
They get scared, so they want to control the situation that scares them.
Good point, Dana. Yeah.
And it can make it a little bit easier to restrain your violent impulses.
Not to punch them, if I think, well, a podcast is Fear Me Out.
Yes.
So we're talking about fear.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, I mean, I learned this lesson about the death and all of that through an experience I had with a very dear friend whose son was killed in a really tragic, horrible, sudden accident. And his son was in his 20s, and actually it was his 21st birthday.
Oh, my God.
So terrible. And when I found out that this young man died, I, you know, approached his dad. We didn't know each other that well, but I could just tell that he was, you know, really suffering. And some of it was cultural. He comes from a Hispanic background, and, you know, you're supposed to be kind of stoic and all that sort of thing. And he was just, I could just see the rage in his eyes.
Oh.
And he said to me, if one more person tells me that my son is in a better place, I'm going to kill them.
Exactly.
Right? And he was just beside himself, right? Because it's so insulting to say that to somebody, number one. And I said to him, you know, that the people that say that to you, they're not saying it to you. They're saying it to themselves, right? Because they don't want to even acknowledge that this could happen to them.
That's true.
So if they can convince themselves that it's not that big of a deal, then they don't have to be scared about something like that happening to them. And he said, oh, you know, I never thought about it like that before.
Good.
He said, I just thought people were idiots.
Really? Well, they are.
Well, and that could be very well be true. But I said
to him,
you know, I wouldn't take it seriously when somebody says that, because they're saying it to make themselves feel better, not you. Because they don't know what to do when they see how sad you are and how, you know, how bereft you are, and that, you know. And it made a difference to him to actually hear that.
Sure, he did. It did. Well, I can tell with some of my friends who have been good friends for years, but maybe I haven't seen them for a while, they're so uncomfortable with the part of me that is unhappy, suffering, wants to die, that they say, what happened? You're not the Gwen I used to know. And I think, well, I'm doing the best I can, but I'm not Gwen who didn't, you know, before Roger had dementia. I'm not that person.
Right.
But I think, yeah, there is this desire to fix things in our culture. And then around death, like the 21-year-old man, people say the stupidest things, like God is taking him away to be in a better place.
Right.
I that makes me furious.
Yeah.
And that he's in a better place, or he's at peace now, or how can you say that about a 21-year-old? Who knows if there's a God doing anything? Who knows if the kid's at peace? Who knows if he's anywhere?
Well, it also denies the pain of the person that's suffering.
Right. That's true, it does.
And there is no way to make it through that kind of heartbreak without suffering the deepest, most agonizing pain that a person could ever go through.
You're right, that's totally
And I
true.
Think that scares a lot of people, the idea that that there's a part of life that is incredibly painful and that nobody gets a life without pain and suffering.
True.
And sometimes, as we know, you know, good people have to suffer really horrible losses
and
terrible things. And it does, you know, make us feel helpless. But I will tell you, I didn't feel helpless in relationship to this man, because I knew that what he needed was love.
Right.
Right. And we really didn't know each other very well. But we were standing outside the athletic club one day in the parking lot, and I just put my arms around him. We both started sobbing.
Aww.
And he was so embarrassed. You know, because I don't think he'd ever actually embraced a man before, number one, and, you know, opened his heart. But it just felt so good to, you know.
That's what he needed.
He did. And we've been so close ever since that time. Because
you still are in relationship?
Yeah, because, you know, it was just a moment to show what love looks like, and that it's okay to be miserable and to be in an enormous amount of pain.
That it's normal to be that way.
And if you don't let yourself feel it, it's going to turn into anxiety and depression and some other kind of debilitating symptoms, because those feelings don't go away just because you you would prefer not to feel them. Right? I once remember reading a study about heroin addicts. I know this doesn't sound like it applies in any way.
I'm sure it does.
But somebody did a worldwide study on people that became addicted to heroin. They were trying to figure out if there was like a similar trait amongst people that chose narcotics as a way in life. And they found that in about 98% of people that got addicted to heroin, they had huge amounts of unresolved grief.
Oh, wow.
And that unresolved grief led them toward wanting to numb themselves.
Oh.
Because, you know, that's what narcotics do. They, you know, they make you numb.
It kind of sounds good to me. I've often wondered if I couldn't just try a little for
a
minute.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is, it does maybe feel good in the moment,
right.
But the side effects are not so good.
Oh, and then your life is, you know,
completely destroyed.
Right. So I haven't done it.
No. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, maybe, I don't know. I've sadly had to take narcotics for you know, major surgical procedures, and I don't think they make the pain go away. I just make that they make you not care about how much pain you're in.
Oh dear,
that was my experience. The pain wasn't gone, but it made me like, oh, okay, who cares?
Right,
I'll just float around here for a while.
I'll get used to this someday.
Yeah. But I just hated it. I hate that feeling. I don't like not being connected. I don't care how much pain there is waiting for me. But that's my life. I you know, choose a deliberate life of feeling whatever is necessary, because I don't want it to turn into, I got enough symptoms as it is physically. I don't need any more, right? So, I you know, you and I have had many, many conversations about, you know, how to deal with your feelings and all the stuff that comes up. And I just try to encourage you to let yourself feel it and let yourself cry and let it be real and not think that there's something wrong with you, that sometimes you get so angry that you don't even want to live anymore because it just feels so horrible.
I often think it would be a lot easier if I just dropped dead right now.
Yeah.
And I told a friend of mine, I said, I even know how I'll do it. I'll go in the garage and turn my car on. And this was a man, he said, catalytic converters.
Yeah.
And I thought, what? What are you doing?
What does that mean?
I know. So he said, it won't work.
It won't work, yeah. You have to borrow his motorcycle.
You know.
Right.
Exactly. So I think, is one of the things you asked me of what I've done for myself? Or
acupuncture. How do you support yourself?
Yeah, the guy you interviewed, your friend Anthony Carr, is my acupuncturist.
Yes, and he's a lovely man.
For 4 years or more.
Okay.
The stress always goes to my neck my whole life. So my neck is constantly hurting, and I can't, I have range of motion problems. So anyway, he's very good with helping me out. And lately my back has been hurting, which he says is my adrenals.
Oh, okay.
Who the hell knows what it is.
There's always a reason.
Right. So he gave me some adrenal pill, and I have trouble sleeping. So he gave me some a sleep relief thing. And, you know, I'm trying different things. But you said cry, and that's a problem because I'm on antidepressants and I cannot cry.
Oh, so that's that kind of grief has been robbed from you.
Yeah, I know. I get up to a certain level of feeling grief and almost like on the verge of crying, and it stops. And I'm, you know, I did try to go off the antidepressants once and kind of reduce it, and didn't work very well.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're kind of stuck in a...
I'm stuck without crying.
Right.
But this woman in my group, who's not there anymore, her husband had ALS and he died, and she stayed on for a while. She told us that she went to Goleta Beach in her car and went far away, rolled up the windows, and screamed.
Right.
And I have done that. And that is a release.
Does that help?
Screaming.
Yes.
Yeah, because you're just like, how can this be happening? Are you kidding me? And I always swear. Right. That always helps me. So I thought that was a really good idea of how to deal with this.
Yeah.
And everybody in my group is dealing with this kind of loss and, you know, emotionally trying to figure out how to take care of the person and themselves.
Right. Which is really difficult.
Yeah. It's really the whole self-care thing, because you're so busy with your loved one, you can't really think, well, I don't have any time for me. You know, I got to do this and this and this. But people have convinced me in hospice about self-care. And there's a wonderful social worker at Hospice of Santa Barbara named Tiana. And because I'm a volunteer, I've known her for 16 or 17 years. So I've called her on the phone and emailed her a couple times asking for advice or for, you know, where I should look, like if I'm going to ever go to a facility with this whole thing, and also caregivers. And she put me, my caregiver, Poppy, has been with me 2 years.
Oh, that's so
and
good.
Tiana... I knew Poppy already, but Tiana checked with her and saw if she had room in her schedule.
So what does she do for you, Tiana? I'm sorry, what does Poppy do for you?
Oh, she stays with Roger from 9 to 12, Monday and Wednesday, and she's great with him. At first he said, I don't need a babysitter, blah, blah. And I thought, yeah, right, I wish. And so I just thought, I can't fight him all the time about this, but I thought, let's just try this. So she's wonderful. She's a caregiver. She worked at Sarah House. She worked for hospice. And she's the most lovely, beautiful spirited person. She works with the homeless with Showers of Blessing. So she comes over and I leave. And she will often drive Roger somewhere. He loves to go up Gibraltar Road into the mountains. Well, they used to be able to take a little walk, but now with his walking, she's nervous. And so she'll do Shoreline Park with the benches and the breakwater with the benches. So we're trying to figure out where we actually can take him. He won't use a walker. I think it would be helpful, but he insists.
Oh.
And I have a second caregiver now, a man about 35, who's the son of somebody I know. And everywhere I go, I say, I'm in trouble if the person seems real. I need help. I need caregivers. Do you know anybody?
Oh, okay.
And so my sister says, I'm just putting the word out there.
Uh-huh.
I'm not. My father wanted it to be a secret with Mom. I want help.
Right.
I want my friends to understand, which my friends, my really good friends, do. And they give me a lot of support. And one thing they did last Saturday, I didn't used to cook, Roger did, and so I'm not a cook, but I have to be. Anyway, they said, let's all get together, all six of us, and we're going to do it at your house, and we're bringing the food.
Oh.
I said, oh, no, no. And they said, you're going to set the table. I said, you can't do that. Let me do the hors d'oeuvres. And they said, no, you're not doing the food. You have enough,
right.
Which is true. But it's hard to accept something like that.
Yes.
Part of me wanted to say, no, no, I'll bring dessert. And then another voice said, would you just shut up in there? Why don't you just say thank
you? Just say thank you, yes.
And tell them that it's awkward for me to accept that kind of help.
Right.
But we had a great time.
Did you? Yeah.
It was wonderful. And I didn't have to spend the day trying to figure out what to cook, which is not important to me, the food
right.
part.
So I was going to ask you, how did you get to a place where you wanted this to be, you didn't want to keep it a secret?
I think very soon. I'm not a secretive kind of person.
Oh, okay.
I'm outspoken. I just thought, I read there are millions of people with dementia in this country and the world, millions of
right.
caregivers.
Yes.
I'm in a huge group. This isn't anything I should be embarrassed of. I didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
And I want to hear people's opinion, real, not people how to fix it,
right.
but people who said, yeah, I know someone, my son might be good.
Right.
And mom, Linda, who son Brennan is the latest caregiver. I have two, Poppy and Brennan. She said, well, maybe Brennan and Roger could make a little garden together.
Oh, interesting.
That's a good idea because uh-huh. Brennan loves that. So they planted, I think Brennan did it, potatoes. So we have some potatoes in a bag in the yard. And then they put the succulents that we had sort of by the garage. And Roger will go outside and say, those are so nice. You know, it took two of us to do that. So he remembers something about it.
Right.
And Brennan plays the guitar, which I didn't know. And music is very important, I think, for somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia.
Yeah.
It can really speak to them. And Roger doesn't remember much, but before I knew Brennan played the guitar, I bought a little xylophone for Christmas for fun.
Oh.
A baby, you know, like a kid xylophone, because my brother-in-law got one. And so I had my little xylophone, and Roger, when I came home from Roger being with Brennan, Roger said, you know, he can play this. He doesn't know his name. I said, are you kidding? He can play this? So the next time he came, I said, you can play this xylophone? He goes, well, I play guitar.
Wow.
So then he started bringing his guitar.
How nice.
That was great.
So does Roger sing with him? Or just
maybe.
Listen?
He might. I'm not sure because I'm gone. Ha ha. But Roger's singing much more than he ever did. Neither of us can carry a tune. But he woke me up not long ago. It was some song about sunshine. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Oh, said, okay.
Be quiet. It's the middle of the night. And he said, boy, you don't need to worry about sleep. It's summer. You know, it was not summer, but he's singing about sunshine.
It was summer in his mind.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So he talks in his sleep more now. And sometimes he sings in his sleep. But I think Brennan sings, and I'm guessing Roger hums or sings what he can sing.
Wow. So far, you have been able to manage keeping Roger at home.
Right. It's not easy.
No, I can't imagine it would be.
I know. People who love me who are not trying to fix this have said, you know, this is so bad for you physically, you know, that when you're under this much stress and this much adrenaline and you're always on guard and trying to be vigilant, I said, it's going to come out in your body. You know, you can't.
So they're worried you're
this.
Causing yourself harm.
Yeah, right. They're worried that they're going to lose me.
Okay.
Or we lose Roger.
So how do you answer to these people and their concerns about you?
I say, yeah. And I say, I'm just not ready to, he's not ready, I don't think, to go in a facility. And then I've gone and looked at places here in Santa Barbara. And one of the men, I was looking at assisted living, which I right. guess was dumb. One of the men at the one place I looked, at the head guy there said, well, you know, if the person has a diagnosis of dementia, they go into memory care.
Yeah.
Period.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that's even worse.
Even worse. Yeah.
So then now I have to go look at memory care, which is they unlock the door to a certain part of the facility. And some of the people there are like, they look like they haven't woken up in years. So I think I just can't imagine him being there. But I'm on waiting list because I think if this gets so I can't handle it, I'm going to need help fast.
Right. Yes.
And if I'm starting from nothing, I'm going to have a problem.
Yes.
So I make myself go to these places
right.
and tour them and put down a down payment. And I've learned things
uh-huh.
from people in these places and what they try to do.
At, right.
Like in the memory care, one place, they were waiting for food. The memory care people
uh-huh.
were sitting on tables. And
right.
some of them had bibs and all that. And some of them were like, looked like they weren't even talking. And some of them were a little bit more bright-eyed. And the guy said, you know, we try to give them a dining experience. They're still people. And I kind of was surprised. But then I yeah. thought, they are still people. But maybe you have to tell people that they're still people.
Well, because, you know, again, I think when we get scared, we just want to turn away
yeah.
from whatever frightens us.
Yeah.
But I think that what you're saying now, again, you may take it for granted, it's really important, which is be proactive,
yeah,
not
right.
and do the best you can not to be in a reactive place.
You're right.
Because the more proactive you are when something happens, which is inevitable,
yes.
you will at least have some structure inside your head, if not in the world, about what you're going to do. When my mom was still alive, she was living in a condo by herself, and she was not the happiest person in the world, but, you know, it was a nice place, and she was relatively healthy and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized one day that in order for my wife and I to be able to feel safe yeah. in relationship to her, that I wanted her to move into a facility. And, you know, there happens to be a few really nice ones in Santa Barbara. They're like yeah. cruise ships on land, you know.
Unless you go to the memory care.
Yeah, they don't smell bad. And
but you're you know, right, all the activities and cruise ships.
Yeah, and so, you know, I said to my mom, I'm really sorry, but I need you to move into one of these facilities, and it's your choice where you go. But, you know, we've looked at a couple of them, and they're really, really nice. And so I know it probably sounds harsh, but you got to do this for us because we both work. We were still working at the time. And what do we do if there's an emergency?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You know, my wife can't stop working, and I can't stop just because, you know, she fell or whatever happened. So, you know, out of consideration to us, you know, these places are really nice. I promise you that it's not like going to jail, right?
Right.
So I think she was a little bit upset about that, but did it. And I happen to have a spies in place at the facility that she moved into. And all of my spies, which were my friends whose parents also lived
right.
there, would say to me, your mom is so happy in this place. She's like the queen of the bridge thing and this and that. And she's just incredibly social and really, really happy. And so it was a really good decision.
Yeah.
Now, I will not say that my mom agreed with that observation. But when she didn't know that we were coming to visit and we were watching her, she was the life of the party. Sadly, as soon as she saw me,
yeah.
she would, you know, shrug her shoulders and
yeah.
look down and shuffle over and say to me, you put me in jail, you know, just to make me feel bad.
Oh, God. I can imagine.
But it was the right decision
yeah.
because, you know, she lived there for a few years and mm-hmm. made tons of friends, had a really good time. It was,
That's
you
good.
Know, and I think she was actually really enjoyed it, but she would never admit it.
No, of course. She
Not to me.
To feel bad.
Right. Because it was so mean of me to force her into a place where she could have fun and enjoy other people. So I'm only telling the story because I think it is really important sometimes to make an unpopular decision, you know, to be proactive about what you're doing, because the last thing you want to do is have to desperately find
yeah.
a place, because it's not easy to do that.
No, there are waiting lists.
That's right.
Everywhere.
Especially in memory care, because it's a really difficult profession. Right. It doesn't pay very well. And so it's hard to find really clean, nice places to place somebody who needs 24-hour care.
And they're short on staff.
Exactly.
Through hospice clients, I've been to these places, and they don't have enough people working, they don't pay them enough. So then the caregiver goes to a second job after the job they're at. And that's one thing that's been important to me, is to pay my two caregivers more of a livable wage than just try to save money or something.
Right.
Because I want them to feel respected. Caregiving is not just something you have, you know, like a babysitter. There are so many skills involved. So I want the people I am appreciating to know how important they are to me.
That is so kind of you.
Thank you. Well, I'm lucky in that my dad left me money. And this is where my money is going right now.
Yeah.
And there was something else I was trying to think of. Oh, I know. Well, I said how important my support group is.
And yes.
That's anybody out there who's getting in my situation, I really recommend finding a support group if possible.
Absolutely.
Or creating your own if you have friends who have this problem.
Yeah.
You suggested I get a whiteboard years ago.
Because
now when I'm gone, Roger's very dependent on me. I write down 9 o'clock, Gwen errands or something.
Oh, okay.
And another thing that's been important to me is to keep my volunteer work. So I still have a connection with the real world.
Right.
So I have my hospice volunteer work, and I'm a literacy tutor for an adult.
Oh.
We call it adult literacy from the library.
Really? So you teach people adults how to read?
Yeah, but it's the same guy for 13 years.
That is so cool.
It is wonderful. He's my second person I've worked with there, but
I'm assuming he's becoming quite literate.
Well, yeah,
slowly.
In many ways, he's fabulous orally. I mean, he really picks up everything, but his spelling is atrocious. And I think, well, I guess you can get around spelling, but vowels are really hard.
Well, and I'll just interrupt for a moment. Yeah. Please don't hold spelling against him. Otherwise, you'll never talk to me again, because I'm about as incapable of spelling as anybody you'll ever meet. So I can't even tell you how much, I know this is way off topic, but my kids make such fun of me because
your spelling is so bad.
It's really horrible.
Well, it's really a low-level skill. But since I'm an elementary school teacher, I thought, surely I can teach him the vowels.
Right.
A, apple, ah.
Right.
No, I can't teach him the vowels. They have more vowels, and he's Tibetan. They have more vowels in his dialect than we have.
Right.
I mean, but I think so impressed with him that he has, learned English. They have a completely different alphabet. And he lived in India, had to learn Hindi. Anyway, he's a wonderful person, and he's someone I trust to give me advice.
Right.
So I tell him what's going on.
So one of the things that you're encouraging people to do is not give up their whole life entirely.
Exactly.
To devote it to that person that needs care.
Right.
Really, really important things. And I don't know if you take these for granted or not, but it's what you're talking about is extremely important, because caregiver burnout is a huge.
It is.
It's a huge factor.
Yeah, I feel burned out all the time, basically. Yeah.
Well, because you still do the lion's share of caretaking for Roger, and it is really very sweet. But I will say us people that know you from the outside, we worry sometimes about
people are worried,
how much pressure you're putting on yourself to,
Yeah, exactly.
But
my sister came to visit, and because I was getting really frayed, is what Anthony said, and she said, "You need more help."
Right.
And I said, yeah, well, I don't really picture someone living here 24 hours a day.
Right.
If Roger has a bathroom problem at 3 in the morning, I figure that caregiver would have been resting until 3 in the morning, and I'd go, yo, I want help.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, whatever. I lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
But another thing I've done, let's see. Well, the regular doctors have got good ideas, like Dr. Bordofsky.
Okay.
I figured this out. Roger used to love Levi's, and he said, no, sweatpants. The doctor said, okay. You don't want buttons. You don't want zippers. You know, you're going to be in belts. You're going to be helping this person dress.
Right.
So now I have sweatpants. He also said something good. Roger chooses shoes that are hard to get on. So the doctor said, hide them.
Oh, interesting.
Anything that's sort of dangerous or doesn't work with clothes,
hide them.
Yeah. So
that's a good idea.
Yeah, I just put them in a different closet and I leave them there hoping Roger won't say, where is that? So I leave it for a while and then I move it along down the road. Another thing that's helped me is in this book, Dementia or Get Ahead of Dementia, whatever, the woman said, don't argue, reason, or explain.
And that is
the best advice I've had. And I put it on a card, and I try to carry it in my wallet, because part of me is a kind of person to want to argue and explain. And so is Roger.
Sure.
He told me once, if you look up stubborn in the dictionary, you'll find both your pictures.
Yes.
I thought, isn't that charming?
Well, next to mine. I wasn't trying to discriminate.
So, when Roger says these things that don't make any sense at all, a part of me wants to say no. Then I realize even if I go ahead and do it automatically, that doesn't work because he doesn't remember any of the stuff I'm saying. And he cannot be logical.
Right.
He looks like he could be logical.
Right, but he can't.
But he cannot. It's impossible.
So say those three things again, please.
Yes. Don't argue, reason, or explain.
Okay. Because those are all contraindicated with somebody suffering from dementia.
You bet. So if he tells me, if I think he's having a problem getting dressed, which he is, the activities of daily life are going.
Right.
And I try to get out the clothes and say, okay, I'm going to help you with this.
Sure.
I don't need help. I can do this, blah, blah, blah. And it kind of makes me mad.
I bet.
And I start saying, you need help. And then I think, I'm arguing, aren't I? Just try something else. But yeah. Yeah, he will. If he resists some of my good ideas, part of me wants to jump in and say, this doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Well, nothing makes any sense right now.
Really important, Gwen. Thank you for mentioning
that. You're welcome. My sister thinks it's really important that I tell people all over the place that I'm looking for help and caregivers.
Sure,
and
why not?
Ideas. And there's a man in my support group who's a wonderful man, and this is about my son is visiting this weekend with my granddaughter, and she's not easy to kind of keep happy and busy. And so this guy in my group said, well, the gem fair is this weekend.
And
she makes jewelry.
Right.
And I thought, the gem fair. Who would have ever thought somebody in my, dementia support group is going to be telling me what
help
to
you
do
take
with
care
my
of your granddaughter.
And it was perfect. We went to the gem fair, and she was happy walking around, looking at all this stuff. So that was a really great idea something I wasn't even thinking of. And he's been really helpful, this particular man, because he's a retired plumber. So I don't have a shower, a walk-in shower. And bathtubs are dangerous. So he's always giving me ideas about possible remedies for that.
Right. So part of what you're saying, again, I know I'm repeating, is that you just never know when somebody could give you a gem.
That's true.
So
all the time.
Right? So the more that you can kind of share your...
Yes.
Where you're coming from in your life, the more gems you're going to likely receive.
Yeah, that's right. And the more people who become aware of you and think, well, wait, I know a friend...
Yeah, they put it in the back of their...
I have a friend who does this and does that, and maybe that would be helpful. Another thing that's good is Friendship Center in Santa Barbara. Do you know that place?
Well, I think that probably every community has a friendship-type center.
Well, we went and toured, and I remember touring 30 years ago for my mother, and toured one day, and I thought, no, these people are not at Roger's level. They're more kind of not even talking. I mean, they have music and flower arranging and all this, but I thought, this isn't going to work. And then they told me at Friendship Center, they have a morning group on Tuesdays called Connections from 9 to 12 for a higher functioning person. And so I thought, well, who knows? And so I started taking Roger. He's crazy about it.
Oh, good.
I don't know what it is, but he thinks these people are the smartest people he's ever met. He wants me to come.
Well, it's so nice that, you know, you found a venue for him to feel connected.
I know. And these people are great. And they're opening up a second Connections on Thursday. So now he's going to go twice a week.
Good.
He doesn't quite understand how much it costs because he still got an idea of money from the 50s. So I'm hoping he won't ever figure out how much it costs. Another thing I want to say is driving.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That is the biggest nightmare.
Yes.
And I remember that with Mom, Dad, and Roger.
Yeah.
And with Mom, I said, Mom, you know, you could kill a little kid. You can't go driving. And she said, well, I haven't killed anybody yet.
You want to wait till it happens?
Right. I know. I thought, this isn't the normal mother I used to know.
That's for sure.
And so with Dad, my brother had to say, you could lose everything. If you cause a crash, you've got macular degeneration, all your money, your house, your everything gone.
That's right. So, and, you know, he was right about it. I had to do the same thing with my mom because I would watch her drive and think, oh, my God, she's got the slowest reflexes of anybody I've ever seen in my life. And so if somebody walked in front of her, she wouldn't notice until after she ran him over.
That's true. And it's scary to think of how many demented people are driving.
Oh, absolutely. In Santa Barbara.
Yeah, everywhere in Santa Barbara.
The sad part about that, though, is a lot of them are in their 20s and 30s.
Oh.
They may not be demented, but they drive like it.
Yeah, well, they're on their phone. Or
exactly.
But the dementia people are the ones that that's my ballpark right now.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that. I watch people go through red lights all the time.
That's true.
Because they're staring at the stupid screen on their phone.
True. And this, it's doctor, we're just talking about,
Dr. Berdovsky? Are we talking about Mike?
Yeah. But we were talking about driving.
Yeah.
I can't remember how he came up, what he said, but I know the driving. This wasn't him, though. Once I got Roger's daughter and son-in-law to come talk to him about, sorry, you can't drive, Dad. It's not safe.
Right.
We'll drive you. Well, he thought we were all crazy. And then Dr. DeLeo does that quick little
assessment.
Test,
yeah.
And Roger's score was going down, and he said, you reach the point where I have to notify the DMV.
Right.
And it's obviously a legal allegation.
Yeah.
And so he said, but that doesn't mean you can never drive again. You just have to be tested.
Right.
And he said, I don't think you'll do very well on the written test.
Right.
To put it mildly. So so Roger was furious about Dr. DeLeo, never going to go see him again. He's trying to
control remember that.
Me.
Yeah. I remember he was quite upset because he loved his car.
Oh, he adored it. He has an M3.
Yeah.
So then we go into the garage, and like you with your surfboards, uh-huh. right, in your garage. We go in the garage, and there that damn M3 is all the time. And Roger's going, oh, I want to drive my car. Nah, nah, nah.
Right.
So I told his daughter and son-in-law, I said, we got to get the car out
of here.
Got
to sell it.
Yeah. You cannot go see that car every day.
Right.
So Mike, the son-in-law, took over. But again, Roger he doesn't understand that.
Right.
And he just said something the other day about his car. And I said, well, we have one car. And he goes, no, we have two cars. He's either forgotten or willed himself out of remembering. But the whole driving thing is really, really hard. And I'll say something else that's hard is the bathroom.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of an unpleasant subject. But
it's important to talk about, though.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your uncomfortable experience with the bathroom.
Geez. Well, at first it was just, there'd just be pee. So I go in the bathroom and there'd be pee on the floor.
Right.
And I thought, well, if I tell him this, he maybe will help me clean it up. Well, no, he said, how do you know it's mine?
Oh.
Isn't that great?
Oh, okay.
Right, it's mine, Roger. I decided to pee on the floor. So mainly now I'm just wiping it up all the time. Mm. But because he just can't believe. He said, I can't believe this. And then there's he doesn't get to the bathroom all the time in time.
Oh.
And so he might wet his pants a little bit.
Oh.
So then we have to start over with underpants and sweatpants,
right.
which is another job because I'm on it. And then with poop, I don't know what's happening, but I think he closes the door or locks it. I think he maybe doesn't see the toilet the same he used to. And it's like in a chair, he starts to sit on the armrest of a chair. So I don't know where he's sitting in the bathroom, but it's not getting everything in the toilet. No.
Oh.
So I'm cleaning up that kind of stuff.
I'm so sorry.
I know. And people have said, well, have you tried Depends? Well, that doesn't really help at the moment. I think he got worse when I tried Depends. Mm. And he looked at them, they're white, and he said, are these yours?
I'm sorry to laugh. I think I have your underwear on.
Right. Even though it's 20 sizes too big.
Right.
So I don't know if I've said how sweet he is. He's very, when he's happy, he's very cooperative.
Yes.
And that, like, letting me put on the Depends, I thought was a big
yes.
cooperation. Yeah. But they didn't solve my problem at all. You know, if you wet Depends, you've still got wet Depends on, and you
right.
take them halfway
right.
off and drag them around the house, and it's still a problem. But the thing I wanted to say is some people are mean who have dementia, and Roger is mostly sweet and cooperative and appreciative, because
right.
he keeps telling me, thank you for all you do to help me. And then, you know, he'll tell me how beautiful and wonderful I am. He obviously is. I'm his security blanket. So he's, you know, he thinks I'm the most important person in the world.
You know, Gwen, you're bringing a really important point up that I forgot about, which is what you just said, that some people, when they become, when they experience dementia, become just their sweet self.
Yeah.
The more demented that my father became in his old age, the meaner he got.
Oh.
He got thrown out of every facility.
Oh my God.
That he was ever in, because he wanted to fight everybody everywhere he was.
Yeah.
His weird grandiosity affected him in such a strange way in his dementia that he just wanted to show everybody how tough he was and how, he didn't have to listen to anybody, on and on and on and on. He just became a belligerent little kid.
That's awful.
The weirdest thing that happened was when I brought my son to see him in one of these places, he was so sexually graphically perverted.
Ew.
That I was really scared. Like I looked at my son, he's looking at me and like, holy shit, I can't believe my grandpa is saying these things. And luckily he knew that, you know, my dad was demented, but it was awful.
Oh dear.
Really terrible. So he was a very unpleasant person to be around, unfortunately, because all he wanted to do was fight.
And that's awful. And then when you get kicked, the person gets kicked out of the facility, then you're thinking, well, what am I going to do now?
Well, you know, in the end, he actually spent the last few years of his life in his home with 24-hour care, because nobody would put up with him.
That's an awful story.
And it was really terrible. But, you know, that's the reality sometimes,
right.
is that the person just, their worst self shows up. Did for sure.
Lucky. And in many ways, even though I'm dealing with all this, I am so lucky and blessed that my husband is a sweet.
Their sweetness.
Kind,
yeah.
And appreciative. And
uh-huh.
at the Friendship Center,
yeah.
they said he's funny, which he
right.
is.
Yeah.
And he's really friendly to new people. He's kind.
Yeah.
When someone brand new shows up, he wants to kind of
right.
chit chat with them. He loves to talk.
Yeah.
And when we go on a walk, we'll take a walk and he'll see a dog and go, oh, what's your dog's name? How
right.
And I think, who cares? How old's your dog? You know, what
yeah.
breed is your dog? And I think, Roger, you don't even like dogs. But and same with kids. He
right.
just enjoys.
What breed is your kid?
Yeah. How old's your kid?
Right.
He'll Sorry. Think it's a boy. He thinks everybody's a boy.
Oh.
But I'm glad that I can take him out in public. And
yes.
also my caregivers are not telling me, look, I'm out of here. This
right.
guy's a jerk.
Right.
They're
yeah.
not telling me that.
Right. He's not impossible to no. deal with.
And he did something I thought was really cute with Poppy not long ago. He always bugging her to go up Gibraltar. But well, the Gibraltar was closed after one of these
oh.
storms last year.
Right.
So anyway, one day she did go up Gibraltar and he said, you know, that makes you an honorary sister of mine. You're my sister now.
How sweet is that?
And then he said, and you're gutsy, because
right.
Gibraltar's not easy to
no,
drive.
No.
So then the other day she was there and she said, since I'm your sister,
right.
let me tell you, knock it off.
That's so good. So Gwen, you have been so kind and incredibly informative. We have a couple minutes left. I'm just curious, is there anything else that you think is important that we haven't talked about yet? Because you've been so open and so informative.
Well, I'll go to mom. I'm looking at my mom list. Dying at home, I think, is really a gift.
Okay.
You know, we let Mom die at my house. Oh, we took her out of her facility.
Right.
Wherever Roger is, if I'm around, I want him to get to die at home, if possible.
Oh, okay.
With strangers, with right. people who love him.
Right.
And then there are certain rituals for bathing the body after someone dies, and uh-huh. I want to be able to do that.
Okay.
Another thing I think is important is to get someone to cook dinner, if possible. Oh,
yes.
Unless you like to cook. I don't like to cook.
Right.
If I could just not think about food, It would give me more time to plan our outings. I remember when Mom used to say, I want to go home. And she'd be sitting at her house, and Dad would go nuts and go, you are home.
Ah. Yeah, yeah.
And I went to a therapist named Eva Minkin, who's since uh-huh. died, and she said, Gwen, you want to say, what is home to you, Mom?
So, you, again, don't argue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And she had ponies and stuff. And I said, that's where the ponies were, in the boxwood hedges. So then we're talking about her picture of home.
Right.
I used to take her to tea at the Biltmore.
Oh.
Of course, there is no Biltmore. But tea somewhere for a person with dementia, maybe especially a woman, I don't know. Going on a field trip where it's going to be peaceful.
It's
like
nice.
The beach is a wonderful place.
Right, right.
Or going somewhere where you can get a little snack. Oh, there's this group in town that does bicycle rides, the Trishaws. Have you seen
okay.
them?
Yeah.
It's called Cycling Without Age.
Oh.
I just was in one yesterday because of an old lady friend of mine. They go to her facility. She has to be in a facility every Friday, and people sign up. So the old lady and me were in the front seat, and the pilot, they call him, is behind us, and he's pedaling.
Huh.
And he takes you wherever. I mean, you know, they take people. They often go to Heritage House in Goleta.
Wow.
And they'll take people to the beach or to, you know, Stearns Wharf, and sometimes they'll have hot chocolate or champagne if it's a birthday. So there, it's still possible to have outings, I believe, with different people that can be fun. And when Mom turned 70, I remember giving her $71 bills because she never thought she had money. That's another thing. Where's my money? I don't have any money.
Right.
So I went to the bank and withdrew some money, and she said, but that's your money, not my money.
Oh.
usually I think whatever idea I come up with that I think going to help, it usually doesn't work.
Oh.
But it keeps me busy. And sometimes part of it works.
Right. Well, again, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you coming on my podcast. And this information is really important for people. I think that you've been really helpful.
Good. I hope so.
Yeah.
I would have liked to know some of these things years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah. People need to give practical advice, I think, not, they're in a better place.
Right.
But like, what do you do with them right now before they're in a better place?
Yeah, exactly. Well, again, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.